Back for episode 117, if I have that correct, 117. So how are you doing, Joe?
Just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Well, tonight we agreed to talk about compulsory public school education. Public schools, as they've become known here in the States. Well, compulsory education refers to a period of education that is required of all people and is imposed by government. Depending on the country, this education may take place at a registered school or at home. A compulsory education differs from compulsory attendance, which means that parents are obliged to send their children to a certain school. Compulsory education involves both the duty imposed upon parents by law to see that their children receive instruction, and the prerogative of every child is to be educated. So when we say in America, yeah, we have compulsory school, but thankfully we have alternatives, whether it's homeschooling in many, basically in all states now, but also just to seek, you know, private education, Catholic schools, parochial schools and such, not necessarily tied to the, or at least funded by tax dollars. Compulsory schooling began in the modern world, really with the Protestant Reformation. You had Martin Luther, I guess, in 1524, urged the establishment of public schools, compulsory attendance, and this was, I guess, to turn back, I guess he anticipated the forces of Counter-Reformation. John Calvin copied it, so that was sort of a Protestant thing at first. In the United States, it kind of came across with the Puritans in New England. And, Puritan colony, Massachusetts Bay, they established, I guess, their idea of public schools or community schools. Voluntary parental education, largely private education, prevailed outside New England. And the militant Puritans who founded the Massachusetts Bay colony were eager to adopt Calvinist plan of compulsory education in order to ensure the perpetuation of Calvinism and the suppression of possible dissent. So it's always been a concern of public education, is conformity and kind of suppressing dissent. The Puritan influence spread swiftly from Massachusetts to the other colonies of New England, and compulsory schooling spread in the same degree. High Puritan Connecticut soon imposed compulsory schools. 1742, that colony attempted to suppress the dissenting New Light movement by prohibiting that sect from operating any schools. After the founding of the American Republic, Massachusetts, again followed by the remainder of New England, pioneering in the establishment of public schools and compulsory attendance legislation. In its Constitution of 1780, Massachusetts expressly granted authority to the legislature to enforce compulsory attendance at school. Accordingly, in 1789, Massachusetts enacted the first general school law in the country, mandating public schools throughout the state, certifying school teachers and specifying curricula, and enforcing compulsory attendance at school. Vermont, New Hampshire, and Connecticut rapidly followed suit. Maine at the time adopted a system as a district of Massachusetts. Only Rhode Island, again, refused to join the rest of New England. One of the most enthusiastic supporters of public school and compulsory school system was the Essex Junto, or a group of prominent Federalist merchants and lawyers in Boston. Their reason for supporting public schooling or compulsory schooling was, in their own words, the people must be taught to confide in reverence in their rulers. This was, of course, a group of merchants and traders, sort of the business elite at the time. That's a theme we see throughout supporting schooling, public schooling. their doctrine was obedience to the government, and also a major theme of the founder of the public school system in North Carolina. In the South, Archibald Douglas Murphy, in 1816, he outlined the system of public schools as follows. All the children should be taught in them. In these schools, the precepts of morality, religion, should be inculcated, and the habits and subordination and obedience be formed. Their parents know not how to instruct them. The state, in the warmth of her affection and solicitude for their welfare, must take charge of those children and place them in the school where their minds can be enlightened and their hearts can be trained to virtue. There, in the 19th century, the movement towards public schooling really picked up in the United States. There was Robert Owen. He believed in compulsory schooling, and Robert Owen summarized his plan. The system of public education then, which we consider capable and only capable of regenerating this nation and of establishing practical virtue and republican equality among us, is one which provides for all children and at all times, receiving them at the earliest age, feeding, clothing, and educating them until the age of majority. We propose that all children so adopted should receive the same food, should be dressed in the same simple clothing, should experience the same kind of treatment, should be taught until their professional education commences in the same branches. In a word, that nothing savoring of inequality, nothing reminding them of the pride of riches or the contempt of poverty, should be suffered to enter these republican safeguards of a young nation of equals. So that was sort of, I guess, their socialist vision. In the middle of the 19th century, America had its first professional educationist. Of course, the principal figure here was Horace Mann, who could be credited, he's sort of the father of public education. He'd be credited as sort of professionalizing and also bureaucratizing public school education. And his vision sort of informs public education to this very day. The tactic was to form sort of leagues or associations throughout the country to implement this program throughout the country, of course. Good examples were the American Institute of Instruction, founded in New England in 1830, setting standards, these things, and for curriculum and also the training of teachers. Also publishing journals and things like that, professional journals. And this is also when education started taking on more of a social engineering, outwardly or overtly social engineering operation. Education became sort of a form of parapsychology in many respects. But he also, it was in 1852 that Massachusetts was the first state to pass contemporary universal public education. In particular, Massachusetts General Court required every town to create and operate a grammar school. Fines were imposed on parents who did not send their children to school, and government took the power to take children away from their parents and apprentice to them. To others, if government officials decided the parents were unfit to have the children educated properly. The spread of compulsory attendance in the Massachusetts tradition throughout the U.S., especially among Native Americans, has been credited to General Richard Pratt. Pratt used techniques developed in Native Americans in a prisoner of war camp in Fort Marion, Augustine, Florida, to force demographic minorities across America into government schools. His prototype was the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania. 1918, Mississippi was the last state to enact compulsory attendance law. Interesting enough, in 1922, Oregon voted to enact the Oregon Compulsory Education Act, which would require all children between the ages of 8 and 16 to attend a state school, only leaving exceptions for mentally or physically unfit children exceeding a certain living distance from a state school or having written consent from a county superintendent to receive private instruction. The law was passed by popular vote, but was later ruled unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court in Pierce versus Society of Sisters, determining that a child is not a mere creature of the state. The case settled a dispute about whether or not private schools had a right to do business and educate within the United States. Of course, this law was targeting Catholic schools at the time. But by the 20th century, by the end of the 19th century, educational profession had pretty much been established. Public school systems have been created throughout the country, and that's kind of have what we come to know as today's public school system. Of course, a lot has changed throughout with the theorists like John Dewey, of course. His program was implemented within the public school systems. and his idea of sort of equalizing everybody, sort of dumbing everyone down, was his strategy, I guess you could say. But that's sort of a rough history of public schooling into the 20th century. And I guess I can let you take it from there, Joe.
Well, thank you. Yeah, good synopsis. The compulsory school attendance, the compulsory attendance in schools for American children was, you know, an obvious Freemason project. Henry Barnard and Horace Mann were both, you know, big Masons. And if you look at the overall structure, what they were trying to do, it's pretty straightforward. They're just trying to extend obedience out into the education of children. And it's always been, a key goal of any group or person that wants to have dictatorial powers is to have control of the education of children. And so it's odd is that you have this idea of you know, that they'd have to go to school, their laws and advocates that it's compulsory. But the real opponent to that they're battling against is typically the Catholic school system. I don't know if you ever read the book Deschooling Society by Roman Catholic priest Ivan Illich, but you know he goes through a lot of this and he talks about how odd it is that the idea of attendance in Catholic schools somehow doesn't quite fit the requirement of a lot of the modern governments. And so they want to get in and actually start changing what schooling is going on inside of Catholic school systems. And also in terms of homeschooling, right? I mean, you know, if you're an advocate of compulsory schooling, why would you want to get in and put restrictions and conditions on homeschooling? I mean, if the purpose of compulsory education was skill training, my God, the homeschoolers would have this knocked, right? Because they always win every spelling bee. So,
yes.
So this is just preposterous that they would need some kind of, you know, like microscopic analysis. It's obviously a social agenda.
It's proof you don't have to be schooled to be educated, yes.
Yeah. So, but my point is that, you know, like so many things which lead to the workers' paradise and are even presented to us as part of the workers' paradise, public schools, you know, have many things which are valuable and are righteous, you know, conceptually, but you can easily weaponize it, right? I mean, it's very straightforward. You just get control of the curriculum, get control of the training of the teachers, put your political allies in charge of the bureaucracy, and the next thing you know, you've got the production of a slave state.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that, you know, looking at the long march from Barnard and Mann to the onset of the radical gender neutral education that we're facing now in the public schools, I think it's really just a long standing project. And I think that the public schools are compulsory because the idea is that they're, you know, slowly shaping the brave new man and woman or transit person, whatever the case may be. And so, you know, you now are, looking at the fruits of this longstanding project. And you know, you mentioned that group in Massachusetts of merchants and businessmen. I mean, that group is just all descended from the habits of the Green Dragon Lodge that, mm-hmm. The Boston Brahmin class that ran these areas for, you know, all this time. And they were always Masonic. There was always a Masonic agenda that the public just couldn't see. And I would just say that, if I was, a parent, and I was looking at, as an example, look at the public schools around me. I mean, to attend them, you have the compulsory vaccination program.
Yeah.
state of California is up to 70 vaccinations. I mean, and at the same time, autism is, I don't even know what it is. You know, some people say it's 1 in 35, others say it's 1 in 50, but it's just catastrophic. Well, how can this be something that is being presented as, you know, we're just out looking out for the kids, trying to make them good, strong citizens, when they're not even bothering to see this obvious correlation between the mandated vaccinations and poor health, you know? So I just, I don't have any conceptual problems with public education. I think this is a great idea. And, you know, interestingly, like I actually have a bit of experience in it because we tried to set up a charter school. You know, we wanted to have a high school that was more academically focused than we saw the public schools in our area, which had a lot of racial problem, a lot of racial tension because there was Latino immigrants, and they were by and large the focus of the school district because they had more problems. And we were being told that, well, you don't really need to focus on your kids so much because they're just winners anyway, you know. And so we thought that was unfair. And so we wanted to have a charter school that was more, you know, just focused on getting kids into good universities, I would say, was the basic idea. It was very, like, racially diverse, you know, the group. I mean, there were actually some Latinos, but there was, you know, this would have been like a pure melting pot group 50 years ago. There was a lot of Japanese and Chinese people and, you know, Arabs and, you know, Jewish people. There were just all kinds of, like, ethnic kind of individuals, but we were told we were sort of racist. So because of, and so this, you know, I mean, so I, you know, that was kind of left a bad taste in my mouth, that whole process. But I got to, but I had some interesting talks with the Latino families, not the ones that were in our group, but the ones that were opposed to it. And they thought that we would basically be taking resources away from their kids. And And the thing that was fascinating to me is that the parents I talked to, they love the public school system and love the fact that the schools that their kids were going to were like 98% Latino. You know, they thought this was great. You know, okay. Yeah. A single one that said, you know, I won't name the schools, but everyone in Santa Barbara knows that some of the schools are 100% Latino, or at least back in the you know, in 2000. And I think they still are. And but the families that I talked to, they thought that was just fine. What they didn't like about our idea was that we would get, you know, that resources that would be taken out of the public school system in general, and this might hurt their kids. So basically it was kind of just like a resource battle between ethnicities. And the thing is that it was sort of interesting to me at the end of it was that, you know, one of the things that is never mentioned when they bring up compulsory education, I mean, like when in our case they were talking about, you know, even the Incas in 1400 through 1600 had compulsory education, you know, and this was good kind of nation building, and we shouldn't try to extract our kids in a separate trajectory. But, you know, the thing about that argument is that, and of course, Plato advocated, you know, mandatory education of the citizens. But the thing about the Incas and Plato is that that was a case where you're sending your kids out into your own ethnicity.
Yeah.
Right. Now, this is we talked last week about, you know, my opinions of the value of ethnicity. And here's one of the things that is valuable about it. And that is, it is lost in current compulsory education, is that when you are inside an ethnicity, say like it's 1950 Chicago, you're a Polish Catholic, you know, community in the middle of Chicago, you pretty much have your own school district, right?
Yeah.
And when your kid is going off to school, you have a kind of sense of there is nothing but advocacy for the kid, right? Because it's this ethnic pride, this ethnic togetherness, this ethnic looking out for one another. So when you send your kid off to school, that is there supporting, you know, the fact that the kid is leaving and he's gonna be gone all day, and like, who's gonna be watching him, you know? When you are functioning inside an ethnicity, there really isn't any kind of, or there's a lot less reasons to have the kind of nervousness that like parents in our school district had, because the school district, the administration, the teachers, there are all these little, well, there are these other ethnicities, but there is antagonism. You know, there's just overt antagonism. It's kind of like a race warfare fought inside a school board. Mm-hmm. Because the different groups have different things they want to get out of the thing. And many people, just the idea of having the kids from different ethnicities in a school room was in and of itself the only goal. They really didn't care about anything else. They just had this idea that physical proximity was necessary. But see, if you're a parent, you look at that and it's you don't have the same sense of the theoretical Polish, you know, family that I was talking about that existed in 1950 in Chicago. You're putting your kid out into kind of a cultural warfare zone.
Yeah, it's your theory, but it's my child.
Yeah. And so that's lost when you have this mandated integration. So compulsory education in America has always been, like so anything, controlled by Freemasons. They have in mind where we are today, the creation of the Brave New World, you know, semi-human. You know, the stratified intellectual structure, you know, where you've got the deltas and the epsilons, and it's all just moving in the right direction as far as they're concerned. Gender, yeah, that's, you know, let's get rid of that to the extent we can. But this isn't with and of course they represent this to the public of, well, this is the workers' paradise, all of these, the culture of critique has shown us that the culture was racist and homophobic and all, so now we're fixing all these problems and it's just going to be wonderful. Mm-hmm. This is what they tell you, but I mean the fact is that the agenda they have, it just couldn't be more evil. You know, they what they're envisioning is the Brave New World. They're envisioning themselves in a complete dictatorial position where no one can resist their power. You yeah. know, because you know, so that's what I think about compulsory education. I think that parents, you know, need to understand what it's for in our current situation, our current world in America today.
Yeah, I mean, people like Horace Mann, Thorndike, John Dewey, all these so-called reformers, well, they were working for the oligarchs.
Sure. You know?
And that was, I mean, that's demonstrated in the 1902 when Rockefeller created the General Education Board. And I guess he endowed it with like $130 million. That's 1902 dollars. Really jingled in your pocket.
Yeah.
And the goal of the General Education Board is sort of cartelize and monopolize education to put it for the, you know, put it, use it, take it over so you can achieve the agenda or the interest of, you know, the industrialists, the corporations. And I believe it was Frederick Taylor Gates, who was a Baptist minister and a director of the General Education Board. And he wrote of the purpose of education. And he wrote, "In our dreams, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. The present education convention fade from their minds, and unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and a responsive rural folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from among them authors, editors, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we have an ample supply. The task we set before ourselves is very simple as well as a very beautiful one, to train these people as we find them, to a perfectly ideal life just where they are. So we will organize our children and teach them to do in a perfect way the things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way, in the homes and in the shops and on the farm." So that's the attitude they have towards the masses who are being fed this education, And we can see it, that attitude today, you know, with Common Core and No Child Left Behind. And this was done through the gradual sort of a centralization of education. Into the 20th century, you had literally thousands of school districts. Now they're down to a few hundred. And, of course, this is all under the control of the U.S. Department of Education. They're nominally independent, but, you know, they get anywhere from 12 to 50% of their budget comes from the U.S. Department of Education, which was established in 1979. So this is only 40 years old. So here's an example of this case study. Back in the 80s, I guess it was Kansas City school district was taken over by a federal judge under the guise of integration and racial equity. And he determined that the fact that the schools were underfunded, that this was a violation, a civil rights violation. And he arrogated himself the authority to forcibly integrate the schools. And not only that, and also increase the school budgets by as much as $2 billion to modernize these schools. And the idea is you just spend more money, get better education. And of course, decades later, the test results were even worse. Attendance was worse. And nothing had come of it other than a lot of money spent. But in order to do this, this federal judge, I think his name was Clark, was his name, I believe. He imposed, he himself, this is his reading of the 14th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act and Brown versus Board of Education. This is the type of, by his reading, he arrogated himself the authority to raise property taxes. Usually you think that's a legislative thing, to order to meet the requirements he set forth in modernizing the public school system. You know, and so, and of course, a lot of money went to like building movie theaters and schools and pools, and a lot of contractors got rich doing this. But of course, education wasn't any better because he didn't address the core problem, which was just a lack of accountability in the school system, lack of local control, not to mention the problems in the communities themselves, which, you know, no school can really make up for. But that's an example of that, you know, the type of, liberties that the bureaucrats and judges, the unaccounted, unelected, take when you give them this this much power in the pursuit of progressive education to make a better world.
Yeah, in California, we were just devastated with this whole language approach to reading that came about in the late 70s and sit here for almost 20 years. And I mean, it was just catastrophic. The reading capacities sank to just levels that are unimaginable in a civilized culture. And it was, you know, forced on California by radical theorists, you know, who all had cultural goals. I mean, one of the things that was being promoted about whole language was that it will reduce the bell curve. The bell curve was kind of an enemy.
You mean it'll make everyone dumber?
Yes. we can't really raise everyone to a high level, but man, we can at least create, a really low level.
Now that's John Dewey right there. That's his theory. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, and Dewey's very proud of this. And his language then got reused. And Dewey was just a malevolent no sensible person should see him as anything other than a crackpot. And anyone who has insight in history should understand him as evil. But nevertheless, he was being touted as like, well, we should pay attention to this thing and let our kids be educated with it. And of course, then the other one was Noam Chomsky. You know, Noam had these ideas that language was natural, that basically, you know, that they will speak naturally and read naturally, and we don't really need to get too much, you know, in the skill training. And you know, we've actually discussed this in the past, and whole language is a pictographic approach to reading. You know, you gather in a lot of information that has a specific meaning, and you know what it is. Mm-hmm. So if you're reading, you know, Japanese,
Mandarin,
you know, you look at the symbol, you know, you understand, you know, that what that means, and this thing has a definition in your mind, and that's how you've learned it. Well, our language is not based on this. It's phonetic. You have to be able to decode what the words are, because the letters are not the way that you can understand what the meaning is in back of the word. So the whole theory was preposterous, and it was just a good example of how parents are so impotent that they, I mean, eventually some changes were made, but it took a whole generation of damaged children before, you know, there was enough evidence so that people would break away. And this was one of the reasons why when I was, you know, had kids in the school system, we wanted to get them out, because they were, you know, we saw that we could train the kids far better than the school. And so we just basically took over the teaching of the kids to how to read and how to do basic math. And then that in the school, you know, and what happened in the school is that they said, well, you know, these kids are good readers, so we're going to put them with the dumbest kids, the poorest readers, as team leaders, so they can all benefit. And like, again, the bell curve is a bad thing. So it was like, you know, that was a point where you said, well, you know, private school may be expensive, but, you know, at least there you can complain about these things. And that was just a decision we made. We just said, no, we just can't in good conscience.
Like, you can also pull your tuition from it, which gets
yeah,
their attention.
And so it was, you know, the whole thing was a complete nightmare looking back on it. And it was so sad, and it was so different. I mean, those years learning how to read were like, I mean, the most fun thing I ever went through in my life. I just loved that. That was when I was a kid at St. Mary's Military Academy in Tokyo. And the priests, who were the teachers, they really gave you a sense of accomplishment, you know, when you could read a difficult paragraph and explain it and stuff, you know. Yeah. And there was pride, I thought, you know, and I can read pretty well. And, you know, so this was all wonderful stuff. That never happened to my kids. They never had any of those experiences. And so, you know, the public schools now are really just they function as an aspect of, or an operational side of culture critique. They're only there just to keep basically the authoritarian personality principles in play. You know, they have extreme versions of history, you know, that will make sure that, you know, we don't produce fascism in the classroom by having European kids be proud of their background, you know, things like this. No ethnocentrism will be, you know, generated here. So I don't know, you know, what to say. It's hard if you're a parent, you know, and I'm glad I don't face these challenges now. I know you do. I mean, do you want to talk about like the, I mean, if you don't, I wouldn't blame you, but I'm just wondering, like, on a personal level, I mean, this isn't kind of some kind of theoretical issue. I mean, for you, it's actually quite real, isn't it? I mean, because of the approach you're taking to educating your kids.
Yeah, they're unschooled, but we strive to educate them and make critical thinkers out of them. And I think it was John Taylor Gatto who said, with, you know, with the public school system designed to sort of infantilize and make people children for life. And if you look at the general culture, they've certainly succeeded in doing that. You know, so the idea is, you know, at some point introduce to them difficult issues, you know, as they get old enough, but make them start to think critically about these things. And the school system itself, as you said, the culture critique has infested the school systems, the cultural Marxists, the long march to the institutions, the theorists, you know, the theories have been implemented through the K-12 program itself. The whole idea that you need a K-12 program to do this is absurd. The whole idea that you go to a school, you know, there's 4,000 students, you know, and you're locked in your age group. Where in life is, when is life ever like that after you finish school? It isn't. Yet they do this because they want to lock you into your age group, so you're not used to dealing with people of different ages. And so that's nothing. Yeah, it's got nothing to do with how life really, you know, transpires once you get out of school. It's interesting that you know, the whole, what we've had since in the middle century, the sort of electronic testing or the education testing service, the sort of standardized testing that they've implemented, which has been tied to MKUltra, actually, because it was the it was James Bryant Conant, president of Harvard, who was behind this, I think, they started implementing standardized testing to sort of identify, classify people for certain, I guess, professions or endeavors in life. But it's all part of that monitoring, and part of that program was funded by the Human Ecology Fund, which
Right,
people,
exactly right. Yeah.
that's Ewan Cameron. They also funded Ewan Cameron's experiments up in McGill University. Deep, the depatterning these things, these brutal
People, they're
MK.
killing people, trying to turn them into zombies. I mean, this is the moral, and it's so critical. I'm glad you brought that up because you can really see the moral perspective of the people who are in back of all of this, right? Because they're murdering people right and left here, and they could care less. The agenda is control, social control through education.
Yeah, and the school systems create sort of a captured audience. You they're
Yeah.
they can't get out. They're compelled to be there, and they're compelled by circumstance, because for a lot of people, the schooling system has become a warehousing of kids. It's where you dump your kids. That's when you have, not just K through 12, but preschool, which is just where families where there's two parents and both have to work, they can dump their kid off there, and they can have breakfast, lunch, and dinner there. Increasingly, it's also where social services are dispensed. School near me, it turns out almost virtually every child there gets a free lunch. Of course, we all know
Sure.
there's no such thing as a free lunch, but obviously, if you offer that program out there, most parents are going to think, "Well, yeah, I'll avail myself of these benefits. I don't have to pack a lunch." Of course, at a societal level, at a fraction of the cost, those kids could bag a lunch, and the vast majority of parents could muster enough resources to do it. But they're taught not to do it because it's just now it's just accepted. It's just accepted. Now, I know when I went to Catholic school, everyone bagged their lunch.
Yeah.
We didn't have cafeterias with a staff and these things to, but these things are as much they are, freebies for a welfare class. They're also a bit it's welfare for corporations who make money off, the commissary and the contracts that go with it, the flow from these things, and the schools become a sort of an avenue for that, with contracting fraud, building schools, brick and mortar operations. A lot of money to be had with that. And I'm sure that, at every school district, there's a lot of kickbacks going on back and forth to this, and that's what it becomes. It becomes a big boondoggle,
Yeah,
you know.
I want to tell you, you kind of opened a wound with me when you brought up the critical thinking argument that they often, obviously critical thinking is, whatever that the expression, whatever you mean by it, it's important, right? People need to be able to think and criticize things, and it is often used. Against, it's often used by the people who advocate the culture of critique, right? Against, people who are like, they're well, you don't want these things to be opened up to critical thinking. You're opposed to critical thinking, and that's why you're lapsing into fascism, And I always go, really? So, how are the kids really being trained to critically think about the Holocaust? How are we doing, like, learn about, I mean, and then what about, like, the Palestinian situation? Is this something they critically think? How about, like, oligarchic control of the media and propaganda? Is that something that is, like, actually on the agenda of, like, let's discuss this critically, learn how to critically
Yeah, when they
think?
learn about the Constitution, if they do at all about the First Amendment, is that discussed at all?
Yeah, that's the thing. And so, but it just shows you how all of these phrases have just been absorbed by this monolith of political correctness, where the kid they actually think they're teaching the kids to critically think.
Well, look what you on the example you.
Parents will actually claim this, but when you ask them about a few difficult subjects to with areas that need some really clear-minded and critical thinking, that these areas are off limits. You can't even touch
Yeah.
these areas.
And the school itself, and you kind of touched on this when you talked about, forced vaccination, using the threat of denying public school services for people whose kids aren't vaccinated enough. That the schools themselves become an avenue or a vector by which the children are targeted, literally, being injected with toxins. But also, the example you mentioned last week, or was it the week before, about the child that was identified as being transgendered. And through the school system, he was targeted by the ghouls in the psychiatric and psychological agencies or establishment, the school, the medical complex. And it was the school system that how they got to him. This is how they get to
his hustle right onto the operating table.
Yeah.
Without his parents even knowing about it.
Yeah. And they do this in mass and too, the schools, because basically it's the school system. Not only is it the primary way the kids are exposed to drugs and sex. The internet's beating them with sex. Maybe the internet is beating them, but actually, real experience, I guess you could say, because they're dedicated to throwing, teenagers together, male and female in a school, which is just a recipe for all types of problems. But they want these problems. Example of in the 70s, introduction of sex education to deal with the problems of teenage pregnancy. Oh, well, they solved that problem, haven't they? Good work, Of course, these programs did succeed. And I've mentioned about in the 80s with the AIDS hysteria, that was a big thing in schools. And this was an opportunity to bring up all types of unnatural sex acts, normalizing homosexuality by making everyone fearful of this AIDS virus that was out there that was going to get you. And this created the pretext to implement very graphic sex ed curricula that otherwise parents would oppose, but you scare everyone with the AIDS.
And that's where all the sensitivity training toward, mm-hmm. Accepting homosexuals as part of the community came from.
Yeah.
So, in hindsight and standing back, you can see the agenda is just transparent. They're not interested in the workers' paradise. They're basically unbridling sexuality.
Yes. And of course, with compulsory education, you have that. You have the blurring of the sexes, with civil rights laws, Title IX, these things. How now bureaucrats and all this Title IX sounds nice, equal education. Who can be opposed to that? But it all depends on who's interpreting the law. And literally, the law changes, which each successive presidential administration, because a liberal gets in, they get a different bureaucrat interpreting what Title IX means, and there's this radical change in what the law is. Then someone gets in, it isn't quite as radical, and it's interpreted differently. But also, of course, with the public schooling became the primary way in which the judges, the social planners, the engineers imposed racial integration and racial mixing when that's not what the people wanted, nor did the blacks want it, really. They were told they had to have it, that it was a good thing. But they imposed racial integration. But the funny thing about that is how we're taught to believe that opposing racial integration is a bad thing because it was a good thing. Anyone who can afford it segregates. Rich liberals don't send their kids to schools that are majority or even have a sizable minority population for the most part. They choose to send them to private schools that are really segregated. Or at least they don't have problem minorities, So it's sort of this hypocrisy here. But again, the schools themselves were used as a way to experiment. Of course, we talked about busing in the 70s, these things, forced busing and the problems that created. This was also used to kind of break up ethnic neighborhoods. And those ethnic neighborhoods, like you said, ethnicity and local control of schooling. If there's a local patriotism, a local pride, that school is going to be responsive to that community. Now, when you integrate over hundreds of square miles, and you're getting federal funds, and no longer is the people using the school, like the 98% Latino school, I doubt they're the ones paying the taxes, right? At least not.
And it's this you point out, bring to mind something that's so important, and that. When we were driven out of the ethnic enclaves, right, into becoming the deracinated white middle class, we really should have stayed and fought, right? Mm-hmm. Just should have stayed put and just fought like hell to maintain our culture and our lifestyle.
No one understood it.
No one understood it. I think that the thing is,
people don't understand covert warfare. One of these days, we have to do a show on covert warfare and coercion. and the many forms it can take. You know, it's not a bullet, not a gun to your head. It's a
My
lot of
point
other
is,
things.
we thought we were fleeing and this was volition. Actually, we were being driven.
Yes.
You see, that was the thing. We didn't understand that all of these social forces had been put in place by people who knew what was going to happen. You know, they were going to drive the ethnic enclaves, the Catholic enclaves, out of the inner city into the white middle class. And guess what? Here they're, you know, there's pornography and the Brave New World is waiting for them.
Yeah,
Because
a portrayal of this is a lot of these movies made in the 80s about white high schools, like Fast Times at Ridgemont High. That's what you got. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, but it's sort of this wasteland.
Well, it's a pornographic wasteland. It was that, you know, and or Porky's, you know, this kind of they're just these degenerate culture debasing movies that the people who created it should be arrested, for heaven's sakes. And instead, these things became, you know, like the Woodstock of the next generation, you know, where they were defined by this, where they this
There
was.
was a, this came out, remember, during the Kavanaugh hearings?
Sure.
And about, so, you know, the yearbook and these things and the party scene and, people binge drinking at people's houses and, of course, the trouble the girls get themselves into and these things. And just the sort of description of high school life in the early 80s. And there are some people commenting on this. E. Michael Jones commented on this, how literally, I mean, he says his high school experience was completely different than it was for most people in the early 60s. How just the people weren't that debased. And by the 80s, and the popular culture, the public, the sort of the morality among teenagers had been so degraded that he simply didn't recognize it anymore. And just something that we take for granted because, we think things have always the way that we experience it. But there was
Well,
a deplorable decline in public morality and also in the schools in these things. And and who's responsible for this? Well, he started going through all the movies that were coming out, the popular culture. Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Risky Business, and these, these movies that were promoting this.
and of course, Woodstock, you know, I mean, this was all, everything was moving into the sex, drugs, and rock and roll philosophy. I mean, everything was pushing, driving the kids, you know, basically to want to separate from traditional culture, you know, and no one recognized at the time that this could actually all be organized as an attack, you see, but it was, and so that's why, you know, I just say that, you know, if we recognize that we're being driven someplace, then we have a different perspective and we'll fight a little bit harder to maintain our ground.
Well, one thing you got to recognize that there's the enemy,
Yeah.
and it may not be the immediate person that's assailing you, right? It might not be the person you're confronted with. It's the people working behind the scenes that are doing
Yeah,
this.
well, that's the thing is that there's nothing more important or than for any parent than to try to go through the process of understanding who the secret society is, what they are, you know. I mean, it's not that hard really to get to there's enough information now that are floating around the internet. People can actually see who is actually creating the cultural destruction, and take actions to not let them drive you into, you know, more debased circumstances. You know, we have to stand our ground and fight. If we just continually try to flee, we're never going to, you know, succeed in any kind of defense.
Well, the biggest indictment, of course, is the sort of I guess the explosion in homeschooling in the past 20, 25 years, which began sort of evangelical circles, and it's broadened and become more popular among Catholics and also secular people, without any religious thing. Because if you ask people what they're concerned about with school, it's not, yeah, it's the quality of education, but the environment of the school itself. And who has to answer for that? Why is the environment so threatening, to parents or to the children that go there?
Right, but at
And
least the homeschoolers are standing their ground. They're saying, you know, we're not going to let our kids be taken into some debased culture. You know, I wanted to mention a little factoid I think is kind of interesting is that at the same time, you know, you had the 80s debasement really getting in full form, because remember, you also had the gay disco, you know, was starting to be promoted. The gay disco culture had all long since been promoted with by that I mean, you know, with unbridled sexuality and non-romantic relationships, you know. But what was interesting is that I remember the 20th high school reunion, which would have been 87, okay? And it was just incredible how few children had been produced, because they actually had a list of the kids that had come from the class. And this you know, this was 20 years after high school, so this should have been, you know, well into the second half or even winding down the child-producing era.
Yeah.
And I don't think out of a class, there was maybe 800, there wasn't 100 kids, not even close. So maybe 60, 70 children had been produced. So you'd had a complete demographic collapse as well as a cultural collapse, because I would say marriage really wasn't that common. You know, there were couples, there were, you know, but there was, I don't have the data, but I would say 50% of the people were single, you know, certainly a large fraction. That wouldn't have been true in my my parents' 20th high school reunion. They would have had like 90%, 85% married couples. So you can see that the culture had really been changed, and it was done deliberately. We knew the culture had changed. Even at that time in 87, we talked about how strange it is, you know, no marriages, no kids. But we thought this was because we had, you know, voluntarily moved into a more sensual reality. No one at that time had the idea that, well, we were driven by people who understood, you know, human psychology so that they could depopulate certain groups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, this was, you know, this was, of course, after the swinging 70s and the 80s. And I guess... Yeah, you just had a certain. Well, this was by the 80s. Sort of the effects of no-fault divorce could be seen, because I remember in the 70s growing up, I didn't know anyone. Maybe one person was divorced that I knew of, and of course by the 80s, I knew lots of kids, you know, who had divorced parents.
Yeah, you know, and it's such an interesting question, because there was no, you know, that divorce was frowned upon, culture wasn't designed to permit it, but the individuals were higher quality, mm-hmm. in my opinion. You know, they hadn't come from such a debased background. Now, you know, you get basically, you know, a cultural Marxist male and a female who is, you know, had... you know, lived with a woman for 3 years, you know, and you don't have the pieces fit together as naturally as you did when you had kids coming out of, you know, more wholesome cultures. So it's the, you know, how to fix it, where do you actually draw the line? It's hard to really know. But one thing for sure is that if people have, inside them, the understanding that they can see themselves being more happy in a relationship, man, they really should put tremendous effort into trying to establish one. And I know it's tough because the culture is so debased.
Well, they could encourage it at school.
What? I mean, that would, you know, you'd have to have like, 20 hours of sensitivity training if you even brought up such an idea.
Well, I guess what gets back to schooling and how to cope with something like the public school system is when you have broken families, and this came up when you talked about that kid who was subjected to you know, transition, you know, his gender, is that a intact family, especially if there's a mother at home dealing with a domicile and the father earning enough to support the family, is they can better deal with these challenges. Whereas when you have a broken family, you're kind of helpless, and you're too, when you simply don't have time, you're exhausted, you've worked all day. Again, your kid is warehoused, and then you really haven't really known to back you up or to deal when school administration starts playing games with your child, when the school is that malevolent. Whereas if you had families that lived in the community, that had some sort of ethno-religious bond, they could they would have agency to fight something like this. Whereas
Absolutely,
in an atomized society or community, especially with single parents with a single mother, there's nothing they have to draw upon to fight something like this.
and so you have the overt, like the creation of the pill, and at the same time where you have the Playboy magazine and a disco lifestyle is being promoted, so that you have the capacity and also the inclination. Religion is seen is being presented as absurd, and so there's no more moral barriers. So you walk out into this sexually unbridled world, and gee, this looks like a lot of fun. But at some point, you have to wonder about the creation of family. How is that going to ever take place inside this form? It can't. And so, the
Well, I mean, see, this goes back to schooling, because if your school is based on the community, that's the schools, and even like how the school system is a good example of this, is where when you're the younger ages, the sexes aren't separated, but as they got older, they sensibly separated the sexes, and you traditionally had the girl high school and the boy, for the boys, but nevertheless, the families kind of knew each other, and quite often that's where you married some girl from the Catholic school, and the girl married some guy from the other Catholic school, and you had a community there. When you go to some four, some mega high school of multiple ethnicities, pluralism there's no religion, and there's common religion, and everyone's being asked.
You're listening to Billy Joel sing that Catholic girls
You start
start
much
too
too
late. Yeah,
late.
thanks, Billy, you piece of crap. And
Yeah.
so the thing I wanted to mention, I mean, I know this is kind of a segue, but I hope it does make some sense to people listening, is that you talk about, okay, well, the overt side of it with the negative culture, but there's also the hidden side where you have the debasement of the currency, which leads to women needing to work in
Yes,
order for,
yeah.
okay, so you can, it's hard to really see how the Federal Reserve has done it because it's incremental. It takes place slowly. But if you look at gold being, $35 an ounce in 1930, and today it's $1,500, you can see that the dollar has been steadily losing value against real things all every day. It always does.
Yes.
And the reason I wanted to mention this is because we're soon, maybe within a year, we'll have negative interest rates in the
Yeah, they're
United
talking
States.
about that.
Yeah, people don't understand, but this is really going to be catastrophic, because basically what that means is the government is going to be taking a bit of your money, in the event that you are able to save any, you have to hand over a bit of it. It's really just a kind of very, very regressive confiscation. It's hardly even can be called a taxation. It's so overt, but you can imagine when you have negative interest rates. Well, how much family production can go on? I mean, it's really going to be tough for people to set up families, because the currencies will be debased. At the same time, whatever savings you have are going to be, chiseled away. There isn't going to be much optimism when you're having negative.
Well, kids can watch more MTV or go online and buy that, right? And that's,
Workers' paradise. You've got an iPhone and round-the-clock entertainment, pornography.
what good is a woman doing at home anyway, just sitting around, just.
She could easily be, working and getting ahead in the world. So we've just been attacked on all fronts, very sophisticated and organized, from Horace Mann to Noam Chomsky. With the whole language stuff, they know what they're doing. They have a vision of the brave new world. I'm gonna just mention, they're really quite dangerous, because the brave new world, this expression, Huxley had it, Kipling had it, comes from Shakespeare. And in if you ever I wrote an analysis of the play where the expression comes out. You just Google Joe Atwell and the Tempest if you want to read it, and there's no charge. But it's I show that the Tempest is completely based on like Isaiah 31 through 34. So it basically makes these passages in the Old Testament come to life. And I wanted to mention that one of the things it clarifies is this idea of the owl. You know, like, why is the owl always in Freemasonry, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Bohemian Grove, or, you know, like the merry pranksters in Germany are called Google Speak, you know, which is like the owl mirror. The owl in Isaiah represents the desolate world that exists after the Gentiles have been genocided. That's what the owl symbolism is in Bohemian Grove. You know, it's 100% Masonic. They understand, in my opinion, they understand the symbolism. They share it. They don't talk about it publicly. But this is why you see the owl hidden in the dollar bill, you know, the little Masonic piece of paper we have to, you know, store wealth in. And it's why the Bohemian Grove is known as the Owl Club. You know, it has the owl. It's just, the owl is not just domination, it's extermination. It represents genocide. Read Isaiah, and the reason why Shakespeare used the expression "Brave New World." Brave means in that era distracted, doesn't mean courageous. Means like distracted, like fashion braveries, where kind of the meaning is still visible. There, the old fashioned meaning is still visible. A brave fashion, a meaning vivid, you know, distracting. So what they're referring to in terms of Isaiah is Isaiah is talking about how the Gentiles be put into a dream, right? It's going to be this dream. They're following a program here, the people who are like actually putting this thing all together, very old. And so it's really useful to understand this stuff. You know, I mean, people should, when you look at things that are symbols like the owl and think of it relating to Brave New World, well, it's not a wholesome vision. This isn't the workers' paradise, you know. So when you see like this steady decline in population, there was you know, an article kind of, it was almost seen as comic, that this researcher was saying that the reason that there are no marriages is because women can't find any financially attractive men.
Yes.
They don't have money, and, you know, broke and stuff. And I mean, you know, there's just every excuse in the world, and every reason in the world is being created so that we don't produce, but we need to, right?
Well, negative interest rates isn't going to help that situation, is it?
Oh, my God. It's just, you know, and just bear in mind, I mean, it's so obvious theft from the Federal Reserve and the government, because remember, now with negative interest rates, the government can borrow unlimited money. It's just, there's no end to anything. If they don't even have the restriction of interest payments, well, what's there to stop them from borrowing $100 trillion next year?
Yeah.
The wars will just go on forever and ever. So the public has to step in. I mean, how we're going to gain control of the political parties is beyond me, but perhaps there'll be, you know, a moment in time when there'll be enough information that, you know, the alt media has gotten to the public, and the conditions become so catastrophically distressed, you know, for the public, that combination will produce, you know, a strong response, so that, you know, we can fight back in some way. Because, you know, I mean, where, how far down do the negative interest rates have to go before it is ridiculous?
And if you're a guy struggling, young man trying to struggle to earn a living wage, the woman that you may consider marrying owes $120,000 in student debt, who wants to marry into that?
Well, that's exactly right.
So then they swamp the labor force with women. So they've have the wages. And then women complain men aren't there who can earn enough. Well, it's because the labor market's been swamped, you know.
It's all been designed. And, of course, then they bring in immigrants, you know, to go with the women to all compete against what should have been situations that would enable a normal man to be able to afford to have his wife stay at home and afford to have children.
And the ideology steps in to sort of rationalize, put a sugar coating on all this stuff, because now it's liberation. You're liberated to go be a wage slave to somebody who doesn't care about you, your boss, as opposed to providing a home for someone who does care about you, who supports you, you know.
Right, exactly. It's just...
That's just money. You support each other, because if you really don't want to be cold about it, you could find a dollar value or monetary value for the services that a spouse provides at home, a wife provides at home, with cooking and cleaning and managing the affairs of the household, which has a value to it. Just the oligarchs can't tax it. And at the same time, they want to create a situation where everyone's a wage slave, which goes back to the whole purpose of, public schooling education in the 19th century was to make workers, not thinkers,
Yeah, and that's why, the YouTube video of Gloria Steinem's outing as a CIA agent is valuable for people to watch, because when you contrast her version of feminism from the historical feminism and see how unique it was and how anti-family it was and how different it was in terms of, the feminism that had occurred before. There's a great interview by Kathy Sarah Child, I believe her name was, Sarah Child. And she talks about, what a liar. And she didn't understand, I think the real malevolence that Steinem represented, but she understood that Steinem was lying. Mm-hmm. She understood that she was an agent and that the CIA was trying to do something to culture. She didn't understand it. I mean, at that point, it was hard to understand. But, anyway, for someone now wanting to, get an understanding of how feminism was weaponized as an attack, so it all, Tim, when you look at compulsory education, it is really a question of who is ordering the compulsory aspect of it and what they want to teach.
Yeah, it goes back to the moral outlook or the moral approach. Is one of these things where obviously any society is going to have a way to inculcate, to transmit the values, and educate its youth and train them for to take over. But if you have a malevolent force, that's what we had. We had sort of in the 19th century, rise of the oligarchy, and they were able to sort of take over, cartelize certain industries, particularly education. They did it with medicine too, to create institutions that are essentially harvesting systems. Education is a harvesting system, like medicine is, and that it's clear with college now, because it's wages to saddle you with debt and a useless degree, and then you're a wage slave and you're indebted, and you're not going to be a problem for anybody in that situation.
Yeah, and then of course the people are getting so unhealthy now. If you look at, that's why I call them like feedlot humans, because they have so many drugs in them. Mm-hmm. They get drugs through toxic food, toxic clothes, toxic environment. They get into college and they get to talk to the college therapist who's a Satanist, and he goes, you say, well, I'm having some trouble. He goes, don't worry. Here's some Adderall, and then when you feel nervous, here's Ritalin.
Yeah,
and so you end up in, here's Prozac. So the kids then leave university basically drug addicts with brain chemistry that has been altered, and $200,000 in debt. What a future is that, going into an economy that has as its big feature negative interest rates.
Yes,
wonderful. Yeah, really. How am I going to save anything? Of course, you're not going to save. You're not. The culture is now designed so you cannot save.
Yeah, and because the monetary debasement accelerates the cultural debasement. So
exactly, it's all part of the same thing. And so, what are we going to do? Well, we have to, the real barometer we want to apply is someone to rip apart the Federal Reserve System. Like I was saying, there's a lot of just easy to do radical things that could stop the thievery, stop the debasement, because the real theft is the debasement, is where the money is worth less. They just keep creating more and more of it in areas we don't even know. I think there's so much black box.
Oh, I know. There's nothing. There's no accountability.
There's no accountability. Yes. And so this would be the first thing, is to, have absolute 100% audits of every single penny of credit that is ever created, let alone physical money. But it should all be available for every citizen to both understand and know. This would be critical thinking. If you want to teach something in the public school system, teach them how to do an audit of the Federal Reserve. That's critical thinking, you know, so that they can have the brain power, the technical understanding of how, you know, credit and money operate, so they can defend themselves. Mm-hmm. Now the poor kids that come out of high school don't even know what the Federal Reserve is. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's a big project, but an information revolution is occurring. You know, this is, it's just like the description we had of like the deracinated, you know, white middle class that had been created. I mean, no one knew that we were being driven someplace. We thought we were, you know, fleeing, or it was our volition. We didn't understand that there was a social construction that was driving us out. But I think now more and more people are seeing that we're being driven.
Yeah, I think the malevolence is clear when they have, you know.
It's getting clearer and clearer.
Drag queens reading stories to kids in school.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you have kids being dragooned into having a sex change operations behind their parents' back. Yeah,
people should start to understand that they have to, you know, that there will be politically correct intimidation, but so what? Who cares at this point?